We're going to have our second Bible reading for this morning, which is taken from Genesis chapter 1, reading the first five verses, and then Des will bring us the message for this morning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. Thanks, Des.
Last week we commenced our exposition proper of Genesis 1 by looking at the second verse in some detail, having of course framed our subject for some weeks before around verse 1. And we noted last week that this second verse began with a new focus, and that whilst connected to verse 1, verse 2 nevertheless wasn't grammatically a continuation of it, but rather that it began a new theme, the theme of the earth, and the theme that would be the focus of the rest of the chapter. And we suggested that the words of verse 2 could be perhaps paraphrased something like this: "Moreover, the earth as we know it now was in the beginning such that it could never have been inhabited by man." In other words, that whilst containing details about the earth's state, the point of verse 2 was to describe it at that time as being uninhabitable. And it was uninhabitable because of what the three circumstantial clauses or descriptive clauses that make up verse 2 said. And that was, firstly, the earth was without form and void, that darkness was over the surface or the face of the deep, and that the primeval waters enveloped the earth. And in that condition, of course, it was uninhabitable. But we also went on to say that the earth was, as it was quite contrary to being in a state of chaos, as some see it, was in fact God's creative work of verse 1, brought forth from nothing as he intended it. So that what constituted the matter of creation at that time was perhaps subatomic or even pre-atomic, and what made up the formless void, but created that way and in process of being formed for habitation. And so likewise, the darkness and the embryonic waters that envelope the unformed earth were also by God's design. So that to read into the darkness and the waters, that these were in some way intrinsically evil or opposing entities, as in other ancient Near Eastern cosmogonies, is to fly in the face of what's been described of God's good creation here. And when you think of the chaos that the other ancient Near Eastern creation accounts describe of warring gods and evil entities, and deities actually embodied in creation, in the sun and the heavens and the earth, so that God is the sun, or Ra in the Egyptian creation story, or that the heavens and earth were formed from the body of Tiamat in the Babylonian account. What a stark contrast we have in this Genesis account of a God who pre-exists everything, and who is distinct from everything, yet who is intimately involved in the creation of all things, watching, hovering over like a parent bird over the earth, guiding it and forming it to its end. And this personal presence of the Spirit of God not only substantiates this direct creative work of God, but it also reveals his intimate overseeing of his work on the earth. A truth that from the very beginning is also diametrically opposed to everything that the theory of evolution teaches, of a random Big Bang, and of chance happenings that produce life, and of extended years that where we have self-generated life. The Bible, from the earliest verses, describes an ordered creation. And God, who personally oversees his work with a wise and determined aim to produce on earth what he designed from the beginning and for the good of his creatures. Creatures who owe their existence to him who created them, and not some sterile random act or acts of chance and fate. And so where we pick up today then is with verse 3. And what we said last week, that which complements and which completes the incomplete verse 2. So putting the sentences together, it would read more naturally in the original like this. Now the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters, and God said, let there be light. And there was light. Or if you like the emphasis, moreover, at that time when the earth was still in that unformed, dark, embryonic state in verse 2, there God said, let there be light, verse 3. And what we have here is another one of those small sentences which Genesis 1 seems to delight to tantalize us with. Short and to the point, a big fall in meaning. Like when he made the stars, verse 16. Or here in verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. A small verse, but profound with meaning. Here verse 3, God said, let there be light. And there was light. 10 words in English, in the Hebrew only 6. Sounds something like this: Wayomer Elohim Yehe Or. Well, Yehe Or. And he said, Wayomer. Who said? Elohim said, Wayomer Elohim. Be light. Yehe All. And here, yehe is the verb to be. And interestingly, is the self-descriptive name of God that we find in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 14. Do you remember there, Moses was called to lead the people of God out of Egypt. And he was concerned, how can I do this? Who shall I say sent me? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. Which is where we derive the name Yahweh from. And this is the root of this word, is this word Yehe, to be. And so then, let be light is the word for light is all. In the beginning, God created the heavens and earth, and God said, let there be light. So a very short sentence, but a tantalizingly big sentence. So what's tantalizing about it, apart from this verb to be? Well, firstly, try and imagine what it might have been like to have been there in verse 3, present at this great spectacle. For whatever reason, most people seem to like to be at the premiere event or the grand opening of some great event. And I suppose it's because there's always a feeling of excitement and expectancy in something new being revealed. Well, imagine if you were invited to experience this premiere of premieres in verse 3. And you're seated at a vantage point without distraction of you. The curtain's been raised, but in spite of your vantage point, you see nothing, nothing at all. And you squint your eyes and attempt to identify something, anything at all, but you can't, because there's no light. And it's also a bit chilly. And it's a bit about this time of the night that the ladies are saying, oh, I wish I'd put something warmer on to come to this. And you can't see, and it's a bit nippy because it's total darkness. Light and warmth don't exist as yet. But you know something's going on. There are noises, strange noises, like when the stringed section are tuning up in an orchestra. And the bows are being drawn against the strings, making those awkward, squeaky and squawky, edgy sounds. It's not music, but somehow those weird sounds which emanate from a myriad of stringed and percussioned and wind instruments, and which just sound like clamor and discord, now will soon amazingly all come together, and there'll be beautiful music. But not just yet. Now it's just clamor and expectation. And as you're sitting there, nervous with excitement, trembling a little from the cold, curious about the strange noises and squinting and straining your eyes for all they're worth, trying to make yourself see through the darkness, suddenly and without warning, whoosh! You're all blasted out of your chair, and pure light, warm light, engulfs everything. In an environment you've never seen the likes of before, and it's absolutely glorious. And there, for the first time, at this premiere of premiere, the earth once shrouded and cold and dark is center stage, bathed in warm light. What a spectacle that must have been to behold. The preliminary work of creation was complete, verse 1. The earth has emerged formless and void and bathed in darkness and water, verse 2. And God said, let there be light. And there was light, verse 3. The show's just begun. Tantalizing, isn't it? I think it is. But then secondly, apart from this visual spectacle of the creation of light and of its effect on darkness, verse 3 presents us with a series of tantalizing firsts in the book of Genesis. And the first it reveals is that this is the first recorded instance of God speaking in the Bible. And we read in verse 3, and God said. And I wonder if you've ever thought about this concept of God speaking, as we often read of it in the Bible. What does it mean when God speaks? What does it imply? What doesn't it mean? What doesn't it imply? Because when we speak, there are quite a lot of things involved that are subconsciously happening and which we rarely give any thought to. For instance, for speech to occur, you need air. Because air passing over the vocal cords is something that's necessary to produce sound. And that means that we must have lungs to expel the air. And we must have muscles to shape our throats and our mouths. And we need tongues and lips and teeth to enunciate our words. Not to mention the processes of the brain that puts all of these things together. So speech is really quite a complex thing that we probably tend to take for granted. But what does it mean when God speaks? Does it mean that God has lips or a tongue or lungs to produce the sound? Certainly in some religions, these things are very much implied. But what about the God of the Bible? And if God doesn't literally need these organs that we deem essential for speech because God is spirit, then how or why did God speak? Because it's not that God thought the light into creation. Because if that were the case, a different word altogether would have been used. No, he spoke, and it was so. He decreed, and it was fulfilled. And we all know, don't we, only too well, that we can speak at length and only produce hot air. And that our speech can be just like the tuning up of the violin noise. That's something that perhaps some of us are more guilty of than others. That we speak without effect, without purpose. And when we open our mouths, there's just noise. But when God speaks, it's different. When God speaks, things happen. Now, if we're in a position of authority, we may speak an order and have something done, and what's ordered is fulfilled. That speech produces something. But that's an eternity away from God's thought being expressed as speech so that a universe is brought forth out of nothing. That's quite frankly, when you think about it, a staggering thought to try to conceptualize. God spoke, and from nothing, life itself becomes. It is. It appears. Well, just try to imagine it. If you closed your eyes and tried to visualize something that you really want, perhaps, in your mind's eye, and you visualize its shape, and you visualize its essential properties in detail, and then spoke it so that the thing became real. Boy, wouldn't that cast a cat amongst the pigeons if we could do that. But imagine it. If you were able to do that, it would be absolutely incredible. And our lives would be even more filled with clutter than they are now. But that's what verse 3 first reveals to us, that God spoke and that his omnipotence enacted what his omniscience determined to be. And the light flooded the darkened universe by his spoken word. And because none of us can claim to be either omnipotent or omniscient, so we can say that when God speaks, his speaking is therefore not at all like ours. No, God's speaking is something that is infinitely beyond mere vocalization. It's something that is both powerful and profoundly mysterious. And God, being the creator of the tongue and the lip, who designed it in order that man may communicate with man in whatever language or dialect he founds himself in, is the God of speech and communication, who is not tied to mere vocalization and not dependent on physical organs to speak, but who nevertheless, without hindrance, is able to speak a word and through sheer omnipotence create a universe, and who is able to speak that same word and speak into the hearts and minds of men and women so that they're able to hear him. Genesis 1, he spoke the words and the worlds were framed. He spoke and light came forth. And the same God still speaks through the lightning and the thunderstorm, and he also speaks in that still small voice to the hearts of men and women. His speech transcends all barriers. Don't try to understand it. It'll only give you a headache. But it's God's same powerful word that brought light out of darkness in the beginning, that gently spoke to our hearts, transcending mere language, that finds us here this morning. And it may have been a tract that you read, or it may have been a loved one urging you, or it may have been some calamity, but the messenger, but behind the messenger was God, all-powerful, speaking in a way that language alone can't, and which created the life that's in you now is. That's the first in this premiere of premieres in verse 3. God spoke, but with speech that is powerful and purposeful and which transcends words. And it's tantalizing. And that's not even to consider how the triune God, hinted at in his name here, spoken of as the Spirit of God hovering over the creation, brings forth all things by his word, the Lord Jesus Christ. Perhaps that's for another day. But now the second first of this chapter, which is directly connected with verse 3, is that this is the first of seven pronouncements of God's creative work that he declared good. And so having created the light in verse 3, we read in verse 4, and God saw that the light was good. And these are interesting words, verbs, aren't they? In verse 3, God said. In verse 4, God saw. Later in chapter 2 and verse 7, God breathed. Chapter 4 and verse 10, God hears. And then chapter 8 and verse 21, God smells. We look at all of these later as we come across them, but just now we're considering only the first of the second pronouncements that of the good that God had done, that God's creation was good. Now we've considered these seven pronouncements before when we were dealing with the topic of the God who is good. And then we were careful to state that good, by God's reckoning, is an objective good, or good measured by the absolute standard of God. And so good doesn't merely mean pretty good or functionally good. And so the implication of good understood objectively means that by the time we get to verse 31 and the sixth day, creation was perfect. It was without blemish. It was without sin. Most importantly, good means creation week was without death. And so it's an agreement with what the Apostle Paul said in Romans 5, but an entire contradiction to what the evolutionary theory teaches. And so here day one, which includes the creation of the heavens and earth, verse 1, And the creating of light and darkness, verse 3, is God's pronouncement of absolute good on his work, verse 4. And it's his first pronouncement of 7 on his good creation. And most likely the reason there are 7 pronouncements of good on the creation week is to do with symbolism. And where in Bible symbolism, the number 7 teaches both divine perfection as well as completeness. And in Genesis 1, creation week is marked from the first day as good because it was perfect in itself, but also complete as a day unit. And then on day 6, it's cumulatively good, marked by the words very good, implying again perfect in itself, but now totally complete. The week is complete. And the reason for that is to emphasize not only the objective standard of God's perfectly, objectively good work in creation, but also to symbolize that creation week was now complete. That's it. There's no more. Now, the first of those emphases of God's objective good we've already looked at in length. But the second, of completion, there's no doubt more we can think about. And good with regard to completion here signifies, verse 31, that creation, as God had determined it, was now finished. There's no more. It's the end of Act 1. And the show will commence from here. And that everything's in place for man to live. And the drama can now commence. And there's nothing more to add to that creative work. If you like, the earth is formed. Light gives life. Oxygen fills the atmosphere. The greater and the lesser lights govern the day and the night. Land and seas are in place. Living things, trees, vegetation, fish, birds, animals, man, all now exist. And the mandate to rule over and to multiply and fill the earth has been given. In other words, all that needs to be is in place in God's perfect plan. And so the perfect work of creation is complete and so pronounced very good. And what verse 31 of day 6 does is to retrospectively look back to verse 4 and day 1 and to declare the seven goods as God's perfect, complete plan. Or to put it the other way around, what verse 4 does of day 1 is it anticipates verse 31 and day 6. And it's being the first good day of the 7 to come of God's perfect plan commencing. But either way, good is here used to symbolize perfection and completion. Though importantly, perfection and completion of God's perfect plan. And that nothing less than what he intended is proposed here. That every pronouncement of good is upon a work which was symbolically, literally perfect and was now complete. It was the case of omnipotence enabling what omniscience determined, the perfect creation of God who is good. That's the first good then. Our second good then listed. Then, the third first in day 1, which is associated with God creating light, and so which is naturally a follow-on from creating light, is the mention of the first day-night cycle. And as we've already noted at this point in creation, the sun hadn't been brought forth as yet, and that's why the premiere was still initially set in darkness. And so in order to create this first day-night circle, some other source of light, other than the sun, is brought to bear upon the earth. What that source is, we aren't told. Now, that God is light is profoundly biblical. But to say that light is God is not. That's what lies behind the philosophy of pantheism, of God being in everything. So the light then itself isn't God himself. Though it could perhaps be God revealing something of himself that illuminates. Maybe it's his glory. As with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, or Paul on the road to Damascus, where something of God's glory was revealed to them, which before that time wasn't seen. And clearly there are places in the scripture where God reveals his glory not seen before in that kind of way. It could have been that. Or maybe it was the partial uncloaking of the initial created unformed mass in verse 1 in some way, and what would in time become the sun and the stars later. We can't say. We don't know. We're not told. But what this appearance of light before the sun does is it suggests that the earth was already rotating before its light source. And that night and day and morning and evening in verse 5 now commence its order. And that, as you probably well know, introduces the most divisive of issues in Genesis 1. And that is the length of time we ascribe to each word day. And as the great bard wrote, thereby hangs a tale. Are these literal days, comprising a literal 24 hours, and that from the beginning Earth's days have always been 24 hours in length? Is that what it's teaching? Or is it, given that days 1 to 3 are before verse 14, when the sun first makes its appearance, are these better understood as non-solar days or pre-solar days? And so perhaps extended periods of time compared to what became solar days from verse 14 and onwards? Or are these metaphorical days, comprising perhaps millions of years, and that the author himself had no interest at all in the length of days in creation? His intent was merely to present snapshots of creation, which essentially say that God created. Well, these various interpretations of the creative days will have to wait until next time, and then we'll give our full time to deal with them. But my point here is simply that because of the introduction of light in verse 3, so we are introduced to the first cycle, the first day-night cycle in Genesis 1. So that day and night cycle is dependent upon this light source created in verse 3. And then very quickly note the fourth first introduced here after the creation of light in verse 3 is this is the first time that God names anything in the Bible. Verse 5, God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the naming of things is found often, you well know, in the Bible. And the first time we find it here is in Genesis 1 with regard to God naming things. And then later in chapter 2, we find it with regard to Adam naming things. And in chapter 1, God gives names. Here, verse 5, to the day and the night. The light he called day and the darkness he called night. In verse 8, God called the expanse heaven. In verse 9, the dry lands he called earth. And verse 10, the waters he gathered he called seas. And then in chapter 2, verses 19 and 20, Adam names the animals and the birds. He called them by names. And perhaps he even named Eden and the four rivers that flowed from it. But the significance of naming things is something that's found in the records of some of the other ancient cultures and races besides the Hebrew. For instance, there's an Egyptian text that speaks of a time before creation when no name of anything had been named. Or if you like, a time of nothingness reflected or expressed in namelessness. And other studies reflect the same thought as well. So that to have no names, it's thought, implies to have no existence whatever. And of course, both names and naming are seen as particularly important in the Bible, and not least with regard to the names of God. So much so that on a number of occasions, the changing of a person's name carries great significance. As when God changed Abram and Sarai's name to Abraham and Sarah. When Jesus changed Kephas' name to Peter. Or even when Pharaoh Necho changed Eliakim's name to Jehoiakim after he gained control of Jerusalem. And what name changing infers essentially is the sovereignty of the one who does it over the one that it's done to. And in Genesis 1, God's naming the day and the night, the earth and the seas, is saying that he's sovereign over all the things that he's created, that they're his, that he's the creator. And he is the sovereign one of the universe. Just as God giving Adam the right to name the birds and animals is saying, as God's vicegerent, he has authority over all the creatures of the earth, that he has dominion over them and the right to rule over them. So naming is a big thing, and it's the first time that we find that in Genesis. Well, I think probably our time is pretty much gone. We've begun to look at this tantalizing premiere in God's creation and considered those things that are related to verse 3. And God willing, perhaps next time when we meet, we'll be able to consider that vexed subject of days beginning at where verse 5 ends. So let's close there for today.